I'd like to address the proposition of law that are essential, and those are proposition of law one, proposition of law three. These two issues center on, Rule Criminal Procedure 11C3. And the issue, obviously, in this case is whether this procedure was followed and whether, the court in this matter substantially complied with the law. Proposition is obviously that, the court did not, 11C3, along with revised code 29-4506, specifically required that a court, defendant, in this case, wants to plead guilty to a charge of aggravated murder, which includes capital specifications that the court must hear evidence or hear testimony to determine the validity of the plea. 29-4506, the word states specifically, that the pre-judge panel shall examine the witnesses to determine whether in fact the evidence is there for aggravated murder or whether a lesser included offense should be left. 11C3 says essentially the same thing. And what's important about Rule 11C is 11C4 indicates specifically that testimony need not be taken by the court except where there is an aggravated murder with capital specifications.
Counsel, your position is that you can, under the rules, not be a volunteer for conviction. You cannot be a volunteer for conviction. That seems to be what happened here.
I guess, yes and no. I think that you can't waive, the state in this case has an interest. If they have an interest to make sure the legislature clearly intended by the requirement that this court review each other, that you're right, someone can't just come in and waive everything and say, I want the death penalty, and take it without some assurances that the case is deserving of the death penalty. I think that in this case there's no question as far as...
Well, you can waive off making a statement in mitigation and those kinds of things.
Sure, but you can't...
After conviction could very well lead...
It has. I'm not aware this court is aware of cases where that has happened.
But the first step in the process is not waivable.
I think that the intent of the legislature is clear that it's not waivable. That the interest in this state to ensure that the offense to which the defendant is pleading is worthy of a capital case, that the state's interest in this particular interest outweighs the defendant's. And I think it's shown not only through the statute, the rule, but also in 29-2905, where review is required by this court in every case to ensure that the death penalty is warranted for that particular case. A criminal defendant can't wait to direct appeal. In a criminal defendant...
And what effect, if any, in this particular case, the defense attorney kept saying that's not necessary, whatever the prosecutor was trying to do. Do you think that... To me, sort of looks like invited error, but what is the, in your mind, any application?
I have two thoughts on that. First of all, when you read the transcript closely, what the prosecutor was doing was not going to put on testimony. He said he wanted to give a recitation of facts. I don't believe that in and of itself would have been sufficient. Second of all, when you think about it, I would love in a trial when the prosecutor wanted to bring on proof of guilt beyond reason doubt to say that's not necessary. This wasn't a stipulation. The defense lawyer's purpose was obviously he didn't want to run the fact before the judge because there aren't the facts. That's all well and good, but I don't think you can waive the requirement of the state.
Okay, you get back to the idea you just can't waive
the requirement. I think it's clear from the reading of the statute that the prosecutor, as happens in many pleas, and particularly no contest pleas, wanted to give a recitation of fact, this is insufficient under the statute and under the rule. That's not proof, that's not testimony. The statute says the three-judge opinion shall examine the witnesses. There were no witnesses in court. The first witnesses to come into court were as rebuttal and mitigation. There were no witnesses available for examination by the court during the acceptance of the evidence, which, again, is absolutely required by both statute and the criminal rule. I think it's important in this case to note in the court's opinion, there was never a finding that there was prior calculation design. I mean, the court never made a specific finding, which appears to be required by both the statute and the rule, that the court specifically find there was prior calculation design in this particular case. The court went through the documents that were introduced to it as a reason to show that the aggravating factors outweighed the mitigating factors, but never addressed the sufficiency of the evidence anywhere in the opinion, the written opinion, or even in required review.
Well, it would appear that the trial judges were relying on Rule 11 completely. That a plea of guilty is a complete admission of the defendant's guilt and nothing further is necessary.
I would agree with that assessment. I think that this is a situation where the court didn't read the entire rule and went through the normal plea procedure rather than looking closely at the crime that wasn't in the statute.
Does defense counsel or the prosecution have any obligation when they see and know that the court may have missed something that is necessary for them to do? Do they have any obligation whatsoever to inform the court of their missing something important that has to be done per the statute?
I would argue with the counsel, and I would direct the defense counsel, if I'm aware that something's not being followed, I would say yes, there's an obligation to notify the court.
Well, in this case, it appears that defense counsel was objecting to issues that the court had to do, such as taking evidence, specifically objecting to some of the activity of the court that they knew was mandatory.
I guess my position is I don't think the defense counsel knew the taking of evidence was mandatory. I don't think there's any evidence that defense counsel was aware of the procedures that had to be followed here. And again,
so that he was incompetent from the start.
Ineffective in this particular incident, yes. And also, again, I want to point out, what the prosecutor attempted to do was to give a recitation of the facts. That is insufficient under the statute and under the rules of procedure. The court withheld the ruling. There was no ruling by the court that told the prosecutor, you must cease. I'm sustaining the objection. I'm not allowing you to put on evidence.
So you're saying that only if it can be proven that defense counsel knew what should have been done, but was thwarting the court in doing that, only if you can prove that's the only time that there may be some question as to the activity of defense counsel.
First of all, I don't think it's waivable. Again, I don't think I can object to the prosecutor proving that case. I mean, I don't think if I say, I don't want this witness to come on because he's going to say things prejudicial to my client, and that would prove their case, so I object to it.
Well, defense counsel, obviously, they agreed that. Did they agree with their client that this is the course of action that he should take?
No, they did not. I think they were very verbal in their telling the court that they did not agree with their client that this was the course, but the client had insisted that that's what he wanted, but they went on the record and stated that they were going to fight the death penalty and they were going to do everything they could so they didn't get the death penalty. They stated it right on the record.
What happened?
Lucky
this from a procedural thing. Let's take this as it unfolded, and the prosecutor suddenly wakes up and says, oh, geez, you know, I can't go forward right now because I didn't bring in witnesses. And the judge explains that, and the defendant who is wanted, I mean, he was a volunteer here in a way.
Well,
and the defendant says, Judge, I'm here, I saw it happen, I want to take the stand. You have to stop it with a psychiatric exam.
For the client, yeah, I think it's the client's right to testify should he choose to do so. But again, this is a situation where the state has the obligation to approve. And I don't think that there's anything to stop them from doing it. This is not a matter, again, when the defense counsel objected to a recitation of facts, it was not sustained. There was nothing that the judge said that said, you may not proffer evidence, you may not, the witness was not called. I mean, there was no evidence that there was even a subpoena for any witness to appear on the day of the plea. There was no intent of the prosecutor on that day to put on witnesses to follow the code. This is a situation apparently no one had read the code. No one had read the disclosure procedure, and we're just doing the plea as if you would do an aggravated burglary. And no one was aware, defense, prosecutor, or the court, that anything further was required. And what's important, that this isn't, I object a little bit to volunteer because what Mr. Green said on a number of occasions was, I didn't kill him. This is a situation where prior calculation design was never explained. And nowhere during the plea procedure did the trial court say, Mr. Green, you understand we have a procedure here that I have to be aware that they're sure we just
came. Well, he said something more. He said, I didn't kill him and I want an eye for an eye.
Right.
I want the death penalty.
He said that at his mitigation, but he also, if you notice, when Tammy McPherson testified after she had talked with him a couple of times, he did allow her to get medical release and did allow her to look back. He said, I would accept something lesser. What he wanted was to be punished fairly under the law. And in his view, the law required what he was charged with was the death penalty. The issue here is in no statement that he gave to the police, did he state, I planned this out, I schemed this out, he said, I killed them, that's all I'm saying, I deserve to be punished for. And again, that would be his position today. And this is not a case that the judge, the prosecutor, the lawyer ever said, okay, Mr. Green, you're pleading guilty to the death penalty. Serious as you get. Do you understand what prior calculation design means? Do you understand that even though you killed them, the state has to prove it was prior calculation design? And if it was not prior calculation murder, you're not eligible for the death penalty. Who's ever explained it? The definition of prior calculation design was never explained to Mr. Green at any point during the proceedings.
What is that definition?
I don't have it sitting right in front of me, but it's the planning, scheming. I was down here for Michael Taylor. I'm aware of this court's, you know, rather narrow version of prior calculation design. But still, that is a fact that the jury must find your fact. Three-judge panel, the jury must decide.
Is prior calculation design defined? You said I don't have it in front of me, the definition.
Yeah.
Is there a definition?
No, there's a jury instruction as to prior calculation design.
Okay,
but
so
again, how can a person be making a knowing, intelligent plea to an element which is absolutely required to prove by the state without any explanation of what that means?
I understand your argument, but I'm curious as to what you think is the definition of prior calculation design, not a technical definition. What do you think you have to show? Can it be instantaneous?
No.
5 minutes?
Yeah, I had this argument the last time I was down here.
We have it now.
Yeah. I believe there has to be or should be some planning or scheming or some sort of plan that is carried out rather than just a rage type act that something triggers.
Well, for your client, the fact that one of the victims was bound puts you in a fairly deep hole on that.
Well, that's circumstantial, but I've had cases where someone has been bound and not killed. I mean, it is possible the person was going to be kidnapped and had no intention of killing. I had a case with Mr. Horn recently where the person was bound and not killed.
The fact seems so sketchy that, but for that, you might be in a position where you say nobody seems to know, and he didn't corroborate, apparently, in his confession.
No, he, as a matter of fact, specifically cut off questions other than to say that he was responsible for killing, and he also stated I'm responsible for murder. There was no question about that, but there was nothing.
Part of the problem here in terms of the judges, they didn't even have a report out on what happened, did they?
Pardon?
The three-judge panel didn't even have an investigation that told them what happened.
They, no, the only
they weren't, there wasn't anything there to alert them to the fact that that there could be an issue as to whether or not the elements of the crime are even present here.
I don't believe the issue was ever brought before the court. This was a situation where Mr. Green apparently did not talk to his lawyers, and if anything, no one questioned that he was remorseful or at least accepted responsibility for what had happened. And there was no issue of murder. Carcuffing was never addressed by anybody. The first time testimony was taken, so that there was any insight of what may have happened was when the police saw detectives found on during litigation. And it's interesting there that there was a question by defense counsel to one of the officers asking how much an investigation they did. And basically, what came out is once Mr. Green admitted to the killing, they stopped the investigation.
Factor prior calculation design, where it was going. Or the last inquiry, would the, if a murder was committed with a gun, would the location of the bullet or bullets, where it entered the deceased, possibly be prior calculation design? For instance, you talked about rage. If you really are angry with me, you could shoot me in the leg. But you decide to shoot me in the head. Does it make part of
it? I think it's a good question. One is it's important. Mr. Green didn't bring a gun. I mean, he didn't bring a weapon with him. The murder weapon was a hammer and a knife that was found there.
Trust me, I understand
second
your
of
case.
Well, I don't think in and of itself that the use of a gun, if you hit somebody in the head, it's purposeful killing. You meant to kill that person. But a purposeful killing is a murder. A purposeful killing is a murder. Prior calculation design is aggravated murder. So it is something that you're to consider, certainly. Is it proof positive that it's aggravated murder? No. I would argue that is one factor that may be considered by a jury, but in and of itself, it is not enough.
Think it might even be a factor that the shooting occurred in the head for purposes of showing prior calculation design?
I mean, it's something certainly a prosecutor could argue, but I certainly would not concede that. As a matter of fact,
I'm not asking you to concede it. Do you think it is even an element?
It's not. In and of itself, it's not an element, no. As a matter of fact,
an element to be considered, I mean.
It could be one of many elements that you could consider.
Or at least factor consideration.
As to the mental gymnastics that has to take place for prior calculation of design is one of them. If you have only the location of the shot and nothing else, obviously, that's not enough. But isn't it a factor if you have five or six factors that you may argue to a jury that look at what he did. He did this, he did this, he did that, he did this, and the location of the shot was in the head. But you can take that into consideration in developing a theory of prior calculation and design, can you not?
For instance, in this case, had he brought a gun to the apartment, certainly that's
right.
Something that you're able to
consider. Or if you go back into the car, bring a gun in back
exactly.
Into the house,
sure,
there's another factor.
Absolutely something that you're able to consider.
Right.
No problem with that whatsoever. As a matter of fact, again, in this case, I'd like to point out that the murder that indicates work.
Did his plea satisfy any level of acceptance to you?
No, frankly. I think that particularly, again, this is, if there's any scenario that requires strict compliance, it is when someone is literally giving up play. In this case, again, I don't believe that the...
Any lesser included offense didn't satisfy?
Well, if you allow the court to consider the documents that were introduced before them, and including the statements, yes, I think there's enough there for murder.
For what?
A murder.
For murder. So you feel that his activity justifies a finding of murder in a plea?
Well, that was introduced as evidence before the court, yes.
Let's talk about the practical aspects of this particular case, because this is really what you want to get to argue, I think, next. If we reverse the conviction, it goes back to the trial court, and then, assuming they didn't follow the rules, they'll follow the rules this time, and we come back to the same thing.
If Mr. Green chooses to go through.
Yeah, if he maintains his position, why would you not argue, or are you prepared to argue, that everybody's had their shot at this, everybody's had their opportunity at this to proceed, it wasn't done right, that we just ought to vacate the death penalty and remand it back pursuant to Penix for sentencing?
No argument. Well, I think under Penix, obviously, he can still be, you know, under the new law, he could be given the death penalty again anyway.
Well, the new law doesn't apply to this one, though, does it?
I believe that it does, Your Honor. I think the state says 95. No, it does not, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Our argument in this case was, first of all, that they didn't prove it. It's insufficient for aggravated murder. It's sufficient most for murder. He should be back and be sentenced for murder. If this court finds that...
That's Penix.
Yes. But no.
20 or 30.
We weren't even getting to Penix because the elements aren't there to even consider death penalty. It would be straight murder. We wouldn't even have to address the specifications. That's our first argument.
But there was no finding insufficient. I mean, there was no sufficient finding at all.
There was no finding, period. But our position is that they had their chance to prove all of the elements which they're required to do under the plea and failed to do so. Unlike any case where they didn't deduce sufficient evidence, they can only stay with what evidence is there, which in this case is that it can only show murder.
Let's assume that this is all... The errors you argue are well taken. Is it the fault of the court? Is it the fault of counsel? Is it the fault of the statute? Is it the fault of the system? Or is it defendant's fault as well? My question is, when it goes back then, are you going to claim double jeopardy?
Personally, no. In this case, because I don't know how we could claim double jeopardy. It depends on which you could set back. It's set back on the first one where, say, this court would find, all right, we find sufficient evidence introduced at the time of the plea to sustain a murder conviction and send it back for resentencing on two murders. I don't know how we can claim double jeopardy in that particular instance.
Isn't that just sort of what Penix does?
Well, again, Penix has to deal with
clearly a death penalty case. Reversed.
This would no longer be a death penalty case.
I understand. Is your problem that the sentence is going to be different than parole 20 or 30 if it's just murder?
It would just be, yeah. I mean, as far as Penix says, I don't think Penix applies because it's ineligible for death. He could get two consecutive 15 to life sentences, you know, for this particular case. But Penix wouldn't apply. That's where, you know, to answer the double jeopardy question, or finish answering that, on the issue that it was not substantial compliance, and I think substantial compliance should not be enough in this case. It's got to be strict compliance and for a death penalty. Then I don't know how we could argue double jeopardy on the grounds that, like any other plea clean because the client was never advised exactly what he was doing, but there's no assurances for this or anybody else that the client gave a knowing plea, then in fact, it would be sent back to NOCO.
Because you're arguing that the plea was ineffective and he was never put in jeopardy. No witnesses were called, no statements were made.
Correct.
There's no way it could be dealt with.
Correct. That's the alternative argument. Correct. In closing, Your Honor, that is exactly our position. Pursuant to proposition number one, we would have the court find that the state failed to prove as required all the elements for prior calculation of claims to be remanded for resentencing for murder. In the alternative, that find that the procedures involved were not sufficient to assure a knowing voluntary plea, and ask that this case be remanded back for new proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dowden. Mr. Horn.
Prosecutor representing Cuyahoga County in the state of Ohio. I'm here with Mr. Rob Zuckman, who is also an assistant county prosecutor. I will address propositions of law number one and four. Mr. Glickman will address any other propositions of law that this court might wish to inquire concerning. Your Honors, first of all, I was the prosecutor on this case that took this plea. I did put on the record facts of this case prior to acceptance of that plea. When I did attempt to introduce physical evidence, that being coroner's reports and coroner's photographs and the journal entry, that motion by myself was objected to by defense counsel. And our argument is that there is on the record a factual basis for this plea, and there was a precedent for having this court and any other court accept that based on State v. Post, which is the case cited by appellant's counsel, and that State v. Post stated that a hearing is not necessary. Testimony does not have to be given if both sides can agree or if there is a statement of fact put into the record, and that statement of facts may satisfy any evidentiary requirements.
But defense counsel didn't agree here, did they?
Pardon me?
Defense counsel didn't agree to the statement here, did they?
They objected to me getting into the facts. Therefore, I feel that we can infer that they waived objecting to those facts. And they did not attempt to put any facts on disputing the facts that I put.
But do you feel that you have any responsibility to comply with 2945OC, which requires that three judges shall examine the witnesses and determine whether the accused is guilty of aggravated murder?
Your Honor, this court in State v. Post stated that a statement of facts may satisfy the evidentiary requirements of 2945.06 and Rule 11C3 when counsel expressly or impliedly waived those proceedings or those procedures. What we are saying is that Rule 11C3 requires that the court shall determine whether or not there is an aggravated murder or a lesser charge that the defendant
found what facts did you state that offered proof of prior calculation?
I put on the record, Your Honor, that the bodies of two women were found in an apartment. The women were tied up. One of the women was bludgeoned to death. The other woman was stabbed 8 times.
Is that evidence, counsel, your statement, to which the defense objected, Lovell didn't agree to?
This is what I put on the record. There was an objection made by the defense when I attempted to put this on the record. That objection was overruled.
But so what evidence did the court have? They have statements by you, nothing from the defendant.
That's correct, and that is allowable under State v. Post That's what we respectfully submit. Also, State v. Munich, which is from Summit County, which states that the court is not required to take testimony after the plea is accepted to aggravated murder, but shall determine whether or not the offense is aggravated murder or lesser offense. And they based that decision on the prosecutor giving a statement of facts where the defendant offered nothing. And also from our Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals, State v. Barrage, they state that Criminal Rule 11 does not require the court to examine witnesses, but only to make the determination pursuant to the criminal rule. And they went so far to say that the criminal rule supersedes the statute. Because the statute says shall examine witnesses, the criminal rule says shall determine. And they felt that there was a conflict there and that the criminal rule would supersede.
I guess a couple statements you made highlight for me exactly what the problem is with your argument, or at least a part of the problem with the argument is that you said, well, you can assume prior calculation designed by the fact that, or I guess draw the conclusion that was by the fact that a victim was stabbed 8 times or somebody was bludgeoned to death. What does that have to do with how long before the crime the accused planned the crime? Couldn't right. somebody stab someone 8 times because the victim cause them to be mad or anger and provoke them, for instance, instantaneously? I mean, what is the number of times the stabbing had to do with prior calculation design, as the General Assembly has stated?
Your Honor, the defendant himself, according to his own statement, killed 2 women. In doing that, he bludgeoned one of them. He stabbed that same person 8 times, and he tied a belt around. He did that to one human being, and then he took Deborah Whitmore, who was his girlfriend, tied her hands and feet, gagged her mouth, and stabbed her 3 times through the heart. The reason we feel that goes to prior calculation and design is this is not an instantaneous act. I mean, one has to tie someone up, one has to bludgeon them, one has to take a knife and stab one person, and then stab the other person, one then has to take a piece of cloth and gag someone else. So we feel that this shows the prior calculation. And we feel that since the defendant pled guilty and stated specifically that he did commit these acts with prior calculation design.
No, wait, when did he say that?
When he was asked by the trial court if he accepted, as far as his plea was concerned, and he stated that on page 18 and 19 of the record, that he did purposely, with prior calculation and design, kill Deborah Whitmore, and then he was specifically asked if he did purposely, with prior calculation and design, kill Nancy Allen, and he stated yes to both of those questions that were posed by the trial court at the time of this plea. So, Your Honor, what we're saying here is that there was enough evidence for the trial court to make a determination whether or not this was an aggravated murder. And we cite as precedent these cases, including State v. Post, which allow for a statement by a prosecutor when not objected to by the defense or without the defense attempting to dispute it in any way, shape, or form, which they did not in our case, that this is sufficient compliance with Criminal Rule 11C3 and also with the statute.
What do you...
From what I think it was counsel would say they didn't object. There was an objection, but I think you want to take a different read on that, which might be a reasonable read, that they didn't want the facts trotted out before the court. Yet, to rely on State v. Post, where there is an objection, you want to say the objection is something else. But can you reconcile that?
What I'm saying is that they did not make, I feel that they made an objection because they did not want the trial court to hear these horrific facts more than one time, and they were going to hear them at the mitigation hearing.
But they did not. Isn't that objection a problem for your reliance on that statement of facts?
I don't feel it is. I feel that they did that because they did not want the court to hear these facts twice, but they did not attempt to dispute the facts. That's what I mean by there was no objection.
Well, can it be seen as a dispute of the facts?
I would argue that it was not because they did not attempt to dispute the facts. They did not attempt to put on any testimony to dispute the facts.
We have to write something here that is going to hopefully give some guidance to trial courts and defense counsel and prosecutors in the future. If we follow your argument, instead of saying the rule and the statute are clear, you have to do it this way, this is the way cases that come before us have always done it, how do we give any direction? What kind of direction do we give if we follow your argument in this case where there's so much that's unknown about why people did what they did?
Your Honors, I would feel that this court should state that a factual basis should be given for the plea, that Rule 11C3 can be complied with that factual basis presented, and that the court, then the trial court, shall make their determination that based on that factual basis. I would argue that the statute should be superseded by the rule. The statute states that it shall examine witnesses, and the question that is begged then is, how far do we go to take a plea? I mean, how many witnesses do I put on? How much defense do they put on for the simple fact that we're doing a plea? The defendant did admit that he committed these crimes with prior calculation and design, and what we are saying to him is, well, no, you can't do that. You can't plead to prior calculation and design. We have your testimony before we'll accept that plea. And the inference is also being drawn that he was never fully informed of the facts of this case or what prior calculation and design means by he and the defendant. And there was no requirement that he be explained the elements of the crimes. But also, defense counsel should, at the trial level, should be given the benefit of the doubt, and they did put on the record that discovery was complied with. They discussed this case with the defendant, and if this court would read the discussion that took place between the trial judges and the defendant, one can see that his plea was freely and voluntarily and knowingly given.
Let me raise another issue with you, Mr. Horn. Not in this case, certainly, but in many cases, I guess it's fair to say, death cases that we see coming to this court, there is an allegation that the prosecutor has overstated the facts in either the opening statement or closing argument. And we have to go through those, and sometimes we tell prosecutors, you know, not in this case, it's not enough to be prejudicial, but you've gone over the bounds. Don't we have a problem here with saying the prosecutor can present to the court in a death case the facts in the case? We have a defense counsel who, it seems to me, is some question about his effectiveness, who objects, we don't know why, but there's not a stipulation. There's not a stipulation between the prosecutor and defense counsel. It's this sort of silence. Isn't that a little risky to write law that says it's okay for the prosecutor to present the facts? Sure, the prosecutor should present the facts the way the prosecutor wants to. Expect that. But isn't that what we're trying to guard against? Is that the court that makes the decision whether somebody's going to go to the electric chair is fully apprised of the facts before they make that determination?
By my statement, I do not feel that I'm saying that we rely solely on what the prosecutor has to say. What I am saying is that the defense certainly has the opportunity, if they desire, to dispute those facts. That did not happen in this particular case. What our position is, Your Honor, is that we did comply with Rule 11C3, giving trial court sufficient facts to make their determination.
Counsel, you talk about the objection. The objection doesn't seem to be to the facts per se, but to the fact that, and I quote, we don't think the prosecution needs to introduce any aggravated circumstances, that the appropriate time would be at the mitigation hearing. Do you think that there was any danger in this case that counsel knew of the statute and knew that witnesses would be required, and in their attempt to thwart their own client's desire to get the tax penalty, they deliberately created error? Or do you think they just didn't know it?
I think that they were simply attempting to prevent the court from hearing the facts of this case. Now, whether or not they did that by air, I feel that they waived. If they, at that point in time, did not dispute those facts, if they did not try to disagree with what the statement of facts were that I gave, then they waived, and I don't feel that they have the right now to come back and say that the court made a mistake. They waived at that point in time. And I feel it was because they did not want to report the judge. The defense relies on safety post, and I'm distinguishing it and using it and saying that I feel that it helps us. But thank you. Justice Moore, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Horn. No, I wanted to, does Mr. Glickman want to argue? How much time we have left, but Mr. Glickman, you may argue until the red light comes on.
Your Honor,
if you wish.
The appellant did not address the oral argument on, it was a proposition of law. I have a proposition of law 5, 6, and 7. He did not address 6 and 7, and actually the court got Mr. Warren to answer all the questions.
Okay.
I expected to answer to proposition 4 and 5. I will just rest on my brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Doughton, you saved 4 minutes of your time.
Thank you. A couple of issues that I want to address. First of all, the prosecutor cited Munich and Burberry. Both of those cases that were from the 8th District, 9th District, were police. And both of those cases, particularly the 8th District, made specific reference to the fact that in this case, the defendant wasn't facing the possibility of death sentence. They found substantial compliance based upon the fact that it was an agreed sentence up front. Everybody knew it. It was addressed specifically, and so that they relaxed the rules. I'm not sure that that's correct, but their reason for doing so in that case was it was a plea. None of the cases relaxed by the prosecutor was a case such as this one, that there wasn't up front 100% known there wasn't going to be a death penalty. I also do not find the statute in 11C3 in conflict with each other, because again, 11C4, which is you have to read the entire statute together, states specifically, with respect to all other cases, the court need not take testimony upon plea guilty of no contest. I think that's perfectly clear. I mean, I don't know how much clear it can be that it must take testimony. And the next point that again was addressed was in this case, I'm talking about Mr. Green's case, he was so sloppy that even the coroner's report, when they sought to bring that in, it was never even brought into evidence properly. The defense objected to the coroner's report coming in specifically, and the court withheld ruling. There's no indication it was ever brought in. There was no coroner there. I don't think it would be acceptable as evidence, as testimony for a report just to be handed to a court over objection in this case, and allows the court to have it. The report itself is hearsay. There was nothing indicating who prepared it, when it was prepared, who the person was. It was simply a document handed to the court. That is extremely sloppy in that situation. I don't think that we can say that that was properly introduced as evidence or should have been considered by the court as evidence, because it wasn't brought in properly. And as such, again, there was nothing proved in this case. It's very important for this court, particularly in this type of situation, to give guidance to the lower courts that we can't be sloppy. It may take an extra day, depending upon what evidence they bring in, but when a citizen is facing the death penalty, I don't think that it's or clearly the legislature intended that we be sure before we do execute someone that it's a proper case to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Doughton. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.